Instead of conferring, the King of Italy was reduced to solicit the honors of the Senate, and the consent of the Emperor was made indispensable before he could execute, against a priest or senator, the sentence either of death or confiscation. The feeble monarch resigned the possession of Italy, offered as the annual mark of his dependence a crown of gold of the weight of 300 pounds, and promised to supply, at the requisition of his sovereign, 3,000 Gothic auxiliaries for the service of the Empire. Satisfied with these extraordinary concessions, the successful agent of Justinian hastened his journey to Constantinople. But no sooner had he reached the Alban Villa than he was recalled by the anxiety of Theodatus, and the dialogue which passed between the king and the ambassador deserves to be represented in its original simplicity. "Are you of the opinion that the emperor will ratify this treaty?" "Perhaps." "If he refuses, what consequence will ensue?"
"War."
"Will such a war be just or reasonable?"
"Most assuredly. Everyone should act according to his character."
"What is your meaning?"
"You are a philosopher. Justinian is emperor of the Romans. It would ill become the disciple of Plato to shed the blood of thousands in his private quarrel. The successor of Augustus should vindicate his rights and recover by arms the ancient provinces of his empire."
This reasoning might not convince, but it was sufficient to alarm and subdue the weakness of Theodatus, and he soon descended to his last offer, that for the poor equivalent of a pension of 48,000 pounds sterling, he would resign the kingdom of the Goths and Italians, and spend the remainder of his days in the innocent pleasures of philosophy and agriculture. Both treaties were entrusted to the hands of the ambassador, on the frail security of an oath not to produce the second till the first had been positively rejected. The event may be easily foreseen. Justinian required and accepted the abdication of the Gothic king. His indefatigable agent returned from Constantinople to Ravenna with ample instructions, and a fair epistle which praised the wisdom and generosity of the royal philosopher, granted his pension with the assurance of such honors as a subject and a Catholic might enjoy, and wisely referred the final execution of the treaty to the presence and authority of Belisarius. But in the interval of suspense, two Roman generals who had entered the province of Dalmatia were defeated and slain by the Gothic troops. From blind and abject despair, Theodatus capriciously rose to groundless and fatal presumption, and dared to receive with menace and contempt the ambassador of Justinian, who claimed his promise, solicited the allegiance of his subjects, and boldly asserted the inviolable privilege of his own character. The march of Belisarius dispelled this visionary pride, and as the first campaign was employed in the reduction of Sicily, the invasion of Italy is applied by Procopius to the second year of the Gothic War. After Belisarius had left sufficient garrisons in Palermo and Syracuse, he embarked his troops at Messina, and landed them, without resistance, on the opposite shores of Rhegium. A Gothic prince, who had married the daughter of Theodatus, was stationed with an army to guard the entrance of Italy, but he imitated without scruple the example of a sovereign faithless to his public and private duties. The perfidious Ibamore deserted with his followers to the Roman camp, and was dismissed to enjoy the servile honors of the Byzantine court. From Rhegium to Naples, the fleet and army of Belisarius, almost always in view of each other, advanced near 300 miles along the seacoast. The people of Bruttium, Lucania, and Campania, who abhorred the name and religion of the Goths, embraced the specious excuse that their ruined walls were incapable of defense. The soldiers paid a just equivalent for a plentiful market, and curiosity alone interrupted the peaceful occupations of the husbandman or artificer. Naples, which has swelled to a great and populous capital, long cherished the language and manners of a Grecian colony, and the choice of Virgil had ennobled this elegant retreat, which attracted the lovers of repose and study, from the noise, the smoke, and the laborious opulence of Rome. As soon as the place was invested by sea and land, Belisarius gave audience to the deputies of the people, who exhorted him to disregard a conquest unworthy of his arms, to seek the Gothic king in a field of battle, and after his victory to claim, as the sovereign of Rome, the allegiance of the dependent cities. "When I treat with my enemies," replied the Roman chief with a haughty smile, "I am more accustomed to give than to receive counsel, but I hold in one hand inevitable ruin, and in the other peace and freedom, such as Sicily now enjoys." The impatience of delay urged him to grant the most liberal terms. His honor secured their performance, but Naples was divided into two factions, and the Greek democracy was inflamed by their orators, who, with much spirit and some truth, represented to the multitude that the Goths would punish their defection, and that Belisarius himself must esteem their loyalty and valor. Their deliberations, however, were not perfectly free. The city was commanded by 800 barbarians, whose wives and children were detained at Ravenna as the pledge of their fidelity. And even the Jews, who were rich and numerous, resisted with desperate enthusiasm the intolerant laws of Justinian. In a much later period, the circumference of Naples measured only 2,363 paces. The fortifications were defended by precipices or the sea. When the aqueducts were intercepted, a supply of water might be drawn from wells and fountains, and the stock of provisions was sufficient to consume the patience of the besiegers. At the end of 20 days, that of Belisarius was almost exhausted, and he had reconciled himself to the disgrace of abandoning the siege, that he might march, before the winter season, against Rome and the Gothic king. But his anxiety was relieved by the bold curiosity of an Isaurian who explored the dry channel of an aqueduct, and secretly reported that a passage might be perforated to introduce a file of armed soldiers into the heart of the city. When the work had been silently executed, the humane general risked the discovery of his secret by a last and fruitless admonition of the impending danger. In the darkness of the night, 400 Romans entered the aqueduct, raised themselves by a rope, which they fastened to an olive tree, into the house or garden of a solitary matron, sounded their trumpets, surprised the sentinels, and gave admittance to their companions, who on all sides scaled the walls and burst open the gates of the city. Every crime which is punished by social justice was practiced as the rites of war. The Huns were distinguished by cruelty and sacrilege, and Belisarius alone appeared in the streets and churches of Naples to moderate the calamities which he predicted. "The gold and silver," he repeatedly exclaimed, "are the just rewards of your valor. But spare the inhabitants. They are Christians. They are suppliants. They are now your fellow subjects. Restore the children to their parents, the wives to their husbands, and show them by your generosity of what friends they have obstinately deprived themselves." The city was saved by the virtue and authority of its conqueror, and when the Neapolitans returned to their houses they found some consolation in the secret enjoyment of their hidden treasures. The barbarian garrison enlisted in the service of the emperor. Apulia and Calabria, delivered from the odious presence of the Goths, acknowledged his dominion. And the tusks of the Caledonian boar, which were still shown at Beneventum, are curiously described by the historian of Belisarius. The faithful soldiers and citizens of Naples had expected their deliverance from a prince who remained the inactive and almost indifferent spectator of their ruin. Theodatus secured his person within the walls of Rome, whilst his cavalry advanced 40 miles on the Appian Way, and encamped in the Pomptine marshes, which by a canal of 19 miles in length had been recently drained and converted into excellent pastures. But the principal forces of the Goths were dispersed in Dalmatia, Venetia, and Gaul, and the feeble mind of their king was confounded by the unsuccessful event of a divination which seemed to presage the downfall of his empire. The most abject slaves have arraigned the guilt or weakness of an unfortunate master. The character of Theodatus was rigorously scrutinized by a free and idle camp of barbarians conscious of their privilege and power. He was declared unworthy of his race, his nation, and his throne. And their general, Vitiges, whose valor had been signalized in the Illyrian War, was raised with unanimous applause on the bucklers of his companions. On the first rumor, the abdicated monarch fled from the justice of his country, but he was pursued by private revenge. A Goth, whom he had injured in his love, overtook Theodatus on the Flaminian Way, and regardless of his unmanly cries, slaughtered him as he lay prostrate on the ground, like a victim, says the historian, at the foot of the altar. The choice of the people is the best and purest title to reign over them. Yet such is the prejudice of every age that Vitiges impatiently wished to return to Ravenna, where he might seize, with the reluctant hand of the daughter of Amalasuntha, some faint shadow of hereditary right. A national council was immediately held, and the new monarch reconciled the impatient spirit of the barbarians to a measure of disgrace which the misconduct of his predecessor rendered wise and indispensable. The Goths consented to retreat in the presence of a victorious enemy, to delay till the next spring the operations of offensive war, to summon their scattered forces, to relinquish their distant possessions, and to trust even Rome itself to the faith of its inhabitants. Luderis, an ancient warrior, was left in the capital with 4,000 soldiers, a feeble garrison which might have seconded the zeal, though it was incapable of opposing the wishes of the Romans. But a momentary enthusiasm of religion and patriotism was kindled in their minds. They furiously exclaimed that the apostolic throne should no longer be profaned by the triumph or toleration of Arianism, that the tombs of the Caesars should no longer be trampled by the savages of the north, and without reflecting that Italy must sink into a province of Constantinople, they fondly hailed the restoration of a Roman emperor as a new era of freedom and prosperity. The deputies of the Pope and clergy, of the Senate and people, invited the lieutenant of Justinian to accept their voluntary allegiance, and to enter the city, whose gates would be thrown open for his reception. As soon as Belisarius had fortified his new conquests, Naples and Cumae, he advanced about 20 miles to the banks of the Volturnus, contemplated the decayed grandeur of Capua, and halted at the separation of the Latin and Appian ways. The work of the censor, after the incessant use of 9 centuries, still preserved its primeval beauty, and not a flaw could be discovered in the large polished stones, of which that solid though narrow road was so firmly compacted. Belisarius, however, preferred the Latin way, which, at a distance from the sea and the marshes, skirted in a space of 120 miles along the foot of the mountains. His enemies had disappeared. When he made his entrance through the Asinarian gate, the garrison departed without molestation along the Flaminian way, and the city, after 60 years' servitude, was delivered from the yoke of the barbarians. Luderis alone, from a motive of pride or discontent, refused to accompany the fugitives, and the Gothic chief, himself a trophy of the victory, was sent, with the keys of Rome, to the throne of the Emperor Justinian. The first days, which coincided with the old Saturnalia, were devoted to mutual congratulation and the public joy, and the Catholics prepared to celebrate, without a rival, the approaching festival of the Nativity of Christ. In the familiar conversation of a hero, the Romans acquired some notion of the virtues which history ascribed to their ancestors. They were edified by the apparent respect of Belisarius for the successor of St. Peter, and his rigid discipline secured in the midst of war the blessings of tranquility and justice. They applauded the rapid success of his arms, which overran the adjacent country as far as Narni, Perusia, and Spoleto. But they trembled, the Senate, the clergy, and the unwarlike people, as soon as they understood that he had resolved and would speedily be reduced to sustain a siege against the powers of the Gothic monarchy. The designs of Vitiges were executed during the winter season with diligence and effect. From their rustic habitations, from their distant garrisons, The Goths assembled at Ravenna for the defense of their country, and such were their numbers that after an army had been detached for the relief of Dalmatia, 150,000 fighting men marched under the royal standard. According to the degrees of rank or merit, the Gothic king distributed arms and horses, rich gifts and liberal promises. He moved along the Flaminian Way, declined the useless sieges of Perusia and Spoleto, respected the impregnable rock of Narni, and arrived within 2 miles of Rome at the foot of the Milvian Bridge. The narrow passage was fortified with a tower, and Belisarius had computed the value of the 20 days which must be lost in the construction of another bridge. But the consternation of the soldiers of the tower, who either fled or deserted, disappointed his hopes, and betrayed his person into the most imminent danger. At the head of 1,000 horse, the Roman general sallied from the Flaminian gate to mark the ground of an advantageous position and to survey the camp of the barbarians. But while he still believed them on the other side of the Tiber, he was suddenly encompassed and assaulted by their numerous squadrons. The fate of Italy depended on his life, and the deserters pointed to the conspicuous horse, a bay with a white face, which he rode on that memorable day. "Aim at the bay horse," was the universal cry. Every bow was bent, every javelin was directed against that fatal object, and the command was repeated and obeyed by thousands who were ignorant of its real motive. The bolder barbarians advanced to the more honorable combat of swords and spears, and the praise of an enemy has graced the fall of Vesandus, the standard-bearer who maintained his foremost station till he was pierced with 13 wounds, perhaps by the hand of Belisarius himself. The Roman general was strong, active, and dexterous. On every side he discharged his weighty and mortal strokes. His faithful guards imitated his valor and defended his person, and the Goths, after the loss of 1,000 men, fled before the arms of a hero. They were rashly pursued to their camp, and the Romans, oppressed by multitudes, made a gradual, and at length a precipitate retreat to the gates of the city. The gates were shut against the fugitives, and the public terror was increased by the report that Belisarius was slain. His countenance was indeed disfigured by sweat, dust, and blood. His voice was hoarse, his strength was almost exhausted, but his unconquerable spirit still remained. He imparted that spirit to his desponding companions, and their last desperate charge was felt by the flying barbarians as if a new army, vigorous and entire, had been poured from the city. The Flaminian gate was thrown open to a real triumph, but it was not before Belisarius had visited every post and provided for the public safety that he could be persuaded by his wife and friends to taste the needful refreshments of food and sleep. In the more improved state of the art of war, a general is seldom required or even permitted to display the personal prowess of a soldier, and the example of Belisarius may be added to the rare examples of Henry IV, of Pyrrhus, and of Alexander. After this first and unsuccessful trial of their enemies, the whole army of the Goths passed the Tiber and formed the siege of the city, which continued above a year till their final departure. Whatever fancy may conceive, the severe compass of the geographer defines the circumference of Rome within a line of 12 miles and 345 paces, and that circumference, except in the Vatican, has invariably been the same from the triumph of Aurelian to the peaceful but obscure reign of the modern popes. But in the day of her greatness, the space within her walls was crowded with habitations and inhabitants, and the populous suburbs that stretched along the public roads were darted like so many rays from one common center. Adversity swept away these extraneous ornaments, and left naked and desolate a considerable part, even of the 7 hills. Yet Rome in its present state could send into the field about 30,000 males of a military age, and notwithstanding the want of discipline and exercise, the far greater part, inured to the hardships of poverty, might be capable of bearing arms for the defense of their country and religion. The prudence of Belisarius did not neglect this important resource. His soldiers were relieved by the zeal and diligence of the people, who watched while they slept and labored while they reposed. He accepted the voluntary service of the bravest and most indigent of the Roman youth, and the companies of townsmen sometimes represented in a vacant post the presence of the troops which had been drawn away to more essential duties. But his just confidence was placed in the veterans who had fought under his banner in the Persian and African wars. And although that gallant band was reduced to 5,000 men, he undertook with such contemptible numbers to defend a circle of 12 miles against an army of 150,000 barbarians. In the walls of Rome, which Belisarius constructed or restored, the materials of ancient architecture may be discerned, and the whole fortification was completed, except in a chasm still extant between the Pincian and Flaminian gates, which the prejudices of the Goths and Romans left under the effectual guard of St. Peter the Apostle. The battlements, or bastions, were shaped in sharp angles. A ditch, broad and deep, protected the foot of the rampart, and the archers on the rampart were assisted by military engines. The ballista, a powerful crossbow, which darted short but massy arrows, the onagri, or wild asses, which, on the principle of a sling, threw stones and bullets of an enormous size. A chain was drawn across the Tiber, the arches of the aqueducts were made impervious, and the mole, or sepulchre, of Hadrian was converted, for the first time, to the uses of a citadel. That venerable structure, which contained the ashes of the Antonines, was a circular turret rising from a quadrangular basis. It was covered with the white marble of Paros, and decorated by the statues of gods and heroes, and the lover of the arts must read with a sigh that the works of Praxiteles, or Lysippus, were torn from their lofty pedestals and hurled into the ditch on the heads of the besiegers. To each of his lieutenants, Belisarius assigned the defense of a gate with the wise and peremptory instruction that, whatever might be the alarm, they should steadily adhere to their respective posts and trust their general for the safety of Rome. The formidable host of the Goths was insufficient to embrace the ample measure of the city. Of the 14 gates, 7 only were invested from the Prenestine to the Flaminian Way. And Vitiges divided his troops into 6 camps, each of which was fortified with a ditch and rampart. On the Tuscan side of the river, a 7th encampment was formed in the field or circus of the Vatican for the important purpose of commanding the Milvian Bridge and the course of the Tiber. But they approached with devotion the adjacent church of St. Peter, and the threshold of the Holy Apostles was respected during the siege by a Christian enemy. In the ages of victory, as often as the Senate decreed some distant conquest, the consul denounced hostilities by unbarring in solemn pomp the gates of the Temple of Janus. Domestic war now rendered the admonition superfluous, and the ceremony was superseded by the establishment of a new religion. But the brazen Temple of Janus was left standing in the Forum, of a size sufficient only to contain the statue of the god, 5 cubits in height, of a human form, but with 2 faces directed to the east and west. The double gates were likewise of brass, and a fruitless effort to turn them on their rusty hinges revealed the scandalous secret that some Romans were still attached to the superstition of their ancestors. 18 days were employed by the besiegers to provide all the instruments of attack which antiquity had invented. Fascines were prepared to fill the ditches, scaling ladders to ascend the walls. The largest trees of the forest supplied the timbers of 4 battering rams. Their heads were armed with iron. They were suspended by ropes, and each of them was worked by the labor of 50 men. The lofty wooden turrets moved on wheels or rollers and formed a spacious platform of the level of the rampart. On the morning of the 19th day, a general attack was made from the Prenestine Gate to the Vatican. 7 Gothic columns with their military engines advanced to the assault, and the Romans who lined the ramparts listened with doubt and anxiety to the cheerful assurances of their commander. As soon as the enemy approached the ditch, Belisarius himself drew the first arrow, and such was his strength and dexterity that he transfixed the foremost of the barbarian leaders. As shout of applause and victory was re-echoed along the wall, he drew a second arrow, and the stroke was followed with some success and the same acclamation. The Roman general then gave the word that the archers should aim at the teams of oxen. They were instantly covered with mortal wounds. The towers which they drew remained useless and immovable, and a single moment disconcerted the laborious projects of the king of the Goths. After this disappointment, Vitiges still continued, or feigned to continue, the assault of the Salarian Gate, that he might divert the attention of his adversary while his principal forces more strenuously attacked the Prenestine Gate and the sepulchre of Hadrian, at the distance of 3 miles from each other. Near the former, the double walls of the Vivarium were low or broken. The fortifications of the latter were feebly guarded. The vigor of the Goths was excited by the hope of victory and spoil, and if a single post had given way, the Romans and Rome itself were irrecoverably lost. This perilous day was the most glorious in the life of Belisarius. Amidst tumult and dismay, the whole plan of the attack and defense was distinctly present to his mind. He observed the changes of each instant, weighed every possible advantage, transported his person to the scenes of danger, and communicated his spirit in calm and decisive orders. The contest was fiercely maintained from the morning to the evening. The Goths were repulsed on all sides, and each Roman might boast that he had vanquished 30 barbarians if the strange disproportion of numbers were not counterbalanced by the merit of one man. 30,000 Goths, according to the confession of their own chiefs, perished in this bloody action, and the multitude of the wounded was equal to that of the slain. When they advanced to the assault, their close disorder suffered not a javelin to fall without effect, and as they retired, the populace of the city joined the pursuit and slaughtered with impunity the backs of their flying enemies. Belisarius instantly sallied from the gates, and while the soldiers chanted his name and victory, the hostile engines of war were reduced to ashes. Such was the loss and consternation of the Goths that, from this day, the siege of Rome degenerated into a tedious and indolent blockade, and they were incessantly harassed by the Roman general who, in frequent skirmishes, destroyed above 5,000 of their bravest troops. Their cavalry was unpracticed in the use of the bow, their archers served on foot, and this divided force was incapable of contending with their adversaries, whose lances and arrows, at a distance or at hand, were alike formidable. The consummate skill of Belisarius embraced the favorable opportunities, and as he chose the ground and the moment, as he pressed the charge or sounded the retreat, the squadrons which he detached were seldom unsuccessful. These partial advantages diffused an impatient ardor among the soldiers and people, who began to feel the hardships of a siege and to disregard the dangers of a general engagement. Each plebeian conceived himself to be a hero, and the infantry, who sensed the decay of discipline, were rejected from the line of battle, aspired to the ancient honors of the Roman legion. Belisarius praised the spirit of his troops, condemned their presumption, yielded to their clamors, and prepared the remedies of a defeat, the possibility of which he alone had courage to suspect. In the quarters of the Vatican, the Romans prevailed, and if the irreparable moments had not been wasted in the pillage of the camp, they might have occupied the Milvian Bridge and charged in the rear of the Gothic host. On the other side of the Tiber, Belisarius advanced from the Pincian and Salarian gates, but his army, 4,000 soldiers perhaps, was lost in a spacious plain. They were encompassed and oppressed by fresh multitudes who continually relieved the broken ranks of the barbarians. The valiant leaders of the infantry were unskilled to conquer. They died. The retreat, a hasty retreat, was covered by the prudence of the general, and the victors started back with affright from the formidable aspect of an armed rampart. The reputation of Belisarius was unsullied by a defeat, and the vain confidence of the Goths was not less serviceable to his designs than the repentance and modesty of the Roman troops.
Part 5. From the moment that Belisarius had determined to sustain a siege, his assiduous care provided Rome against the danger of famine, more dreadful than the Gothic arms. An extraordinary supply of corn was imported from Sicily. The harvests of Campania and Tuscany were forcibly swept for the use of the city, and the rights of private property were infringed by the strong plea of the public safety. It might easily be foreseen that the enemy would intercept the aqueducts, and the cessation of the water mills was the first inconvenience, which was speedily removed by mooring large vessels and fixing millstones in the current of the river. The stream was soon embarrassed by the trunks of trees and polluted with dead bodies. Yet so effectual were the precautions of the Roman general that the waters of the Tiber still continued to give motion to the mills and drink to the inhabitants. The more distant quarters were supplied with domestic wells, and a besieged city might support, without impatience, the privation of her public baths. A large portion of Rome, from the Prenestine Gate to the Church of St. Paul, was never invested by the Goths. Their excursions were restrained by the activity of the Moorish troops. The navigation of the Tiber and the Latin, Appian, and Ostian ways were left free and unmolested for the introduction of corn and cattle, or the retreat of the inhabitants who sought refuge in Campania or Sicily. Anxious to relieve himself from a useless and devouring multitude, Belisarius issued his peremptory orders for the instant departure of the women, the children, and slaves, required his soldiers to dismiss their male and female attendants, and regulated their allowance that one moiety should be given in provisions and the other in money. His foresight was justified by the increase of the public distress, as soon as the Goths had occupied two important posts in the neighborhood of Rome. By the loss of the port, or as it is now called, the city of Porto, he was deprived of the country on the right of the Tiber, and the best communication with the sea. And he reflected with grief and anger that 300 men, could he have spared such a feeble band, might have defended its impregnable works. 7 miles from the capital, between the Appian and the Latin ways, two principal aqueducts, crossing and again crossing each other, enclosed within their solid and lofty arches a fortified space where Vitiges established a camp of 7,000 Goths to intercept the convoy of Sicily and Campania. The granaries of Rome were insensibly exhausted. The adjacent country had been wasted with fire and sword. Such scanty supplies as might yet be obtained by hasty excursions were the reward of valor and the purchase of wealth. The forage of the horses and the bread of the soldiers never failed, but in the last months of the siege the people were exposed to the miseries of scarcity, unwholesome food, and contagious disorders. Belisarius saw and pitied their sufferings, but he had foreseen, and he watched the decay of their loyalty and the progress of their discontent. Adversity had awakened the Romans from the dreams of grandeur and freedom, and taught them the humiliating lesson that it was of small moment to their real happiness whether the name of their master was derived from the Gothic or the Latin language. The lieutenant of Justinian listened to their just complaints, but he rejected with disdain the idea of flight or capitulation, repressed their clamorous impatience for battle, amused them with the prospect of a sure and speedy relief, and secured himself and the city from the effects of their despair or treachery.
Twice in each month he changed the station of the officers to whom the custody of the gates was committed. The various precautions of patrols, watchwords, lights, and music were repeatedly employed to discover whatever passed on the ramparts. Outguards were posted beyond the ditch, and the trusty vigilance of dogs supplied the more doubtful fidelity of mankind. A letter was intercepted which assured the king of the Goths that the Asinarian gate, adjoining to the Lateran church, should be secretly opened to his troops. On the proof or suspicion of treason, several senators were banished, and the Pope Silverius was summoned to attend the representative of his sovereign at his headquarters in the Pincian Palace. The ecclesiastics who followed their bishop were detained in the first or second apartment, and he alone was admitted to the presence of Belisarius. The conqueror of Rome and Carthage was modestly seated at the feet of Antonina, who reclined on a stately couch. The general was silent, but the voice of reproach and menace issued from the mouth of his imperious wife. Accused by credible witnesses and the evidence of his own subscription, the successor of St. Peter was despoiled of his pontifical ornaments, clad in the mean habit of a monk, and embarked without delay for a distant exile in the East. At the emperor's command, the clergy of Rome proceeded to the choice of a new bishop, and after a solemn invocation of the Holy Ghost, elected the deacon Vigilius, who had purchased the papal throne by a bribe of 200 pounds of gold. The profit, and consequently the guilt, of this simony was imputed to Belisarius, but the hero obeyed the orders of his wife. Antonina served the passions of the empress, and Theodora lavished her treasures in the vain hope of obtaining a pontiff hostile or indifferent to the council of Chalcedon. The epistle of Belisarius to the emperor announced his victory, his danger, and his resolution. "According to your commands, we have entered the dominions of the Goths, and reduced to your obedience Sicily, Campania, and the city of Rome. But the loss of these conquests will be more disgraceful than their acquisition was glorious. Hitherto we have successfully fought against the multitudes of the barbarians, but their multitudes may finally prevail. Victory is the gift of Providence, but the reputation of kings and generals depends on the success or the failure of their designs. Permit me to speak with freedom. If you wish that we should live, send us subsistence. If you desire that we should conquer, send us arms, horses, and men. The Romans have received us as friends and deliverers, but in our present distress they will be either betrayed by their confidence, or we shall be oppressed by their treachery and hatred. For myself, my life is consecrated to your service. It is yours to reflect whether my death in this situation will contribute to the glory and prosperity of your reign." Perhaps that reign would have been equally prosperous if the peaceful master of the East had abstained from the conquest of Africa and Italy. But as Justinian was ambitious of fame, he made some efforts, they were feeble and languid, to support and rescue his victorious general. A reinforcement of 1600 Sclavonians and Huns was led by Martin and Valerian, and as they reposed during the winter season in the harbours of Greece, the strength of the men and horses was not impaired by the fatigues of a sea voyage, and they distinguished their valour in the first sally against the besiegers. About the time of the summer solstice, Euthalius landed at Terracina with large sums of money for the payment of the troops. He cautiously proceeded along the Appian Way, and this convoy entered Rome through the gate Capena, while Belisarius, on the other side, diverted the attention of the Goths by a vigorous and successful skirmish. These seasonable aids, the use and reputation of which were dexterously managed by the Roman general, revived the courage, or at least the hopes, of the soldiers and people. The historian Procopius was dispatched with an important commission to collect the troops and provisions which Campania could furnish, or Constantinople had sent. And the secretary of Belisarius was soon followed by Antonina herself, who boldly traversed the posts of the enemy and returned with the Oriental succors to the relief of her husband and the besieged city. A fleet of 3,000 Isaurians cast anchor in the Bay of Naples and afterwards at Ostia. Above 2,000 horse, of whom a part were Thracians, landed at Tarentum, and after the junction of 500 soldiers of Campania and a train of wagons laden with wine and flour, they directed their march on the Appian Way from Capua to the neighborhood of Rome. The forces that arrived by land and sea were united at the mouth of the Tiber. Antonina convened a council of war. It was resolved to surmount, with sails and oars, the adverse stream of the river, and the Goths were apprehensive of disturbing by any rash hostilities the negotiation to which Belisarius had craftily listened. They credulously believed that they saw no more than the vanguard of a fleet and army which already covered the Ionian Sea and the plains of Campania. And the illusion was supported by the haughty language of the Roman general when he gave audience to the ambassadors of Vitiges. After a specious discourse to vindicate the justice of his cause, they declared that, for the sake of peace, they were disposed to renounce the possession of Sicily. "The emperor is not less generous," replied his lieutenant with a disdainful smile, "in return for a gift which you no longer possess. He presents you with an ancient province of the empire. He resigns to the Goths the sovereignty of the British island." Belisarius rejected with equal firmness and contempt the offer of a tribute, but he allowed the Gothic ambassadors to seek their fate from the mouth of Justinian himself, and consented with seeming reluctance to a truce of 3 months, from the winter solstice to the equinox of spring. Prudence might not safely trust either the oaths or hostages of the barbarians, and the conscious superiority of the Roman chief was expressed in the distribution of his troops. As soon as fear or hunger compelled the Goths to evacuate Alba, Porto, and Centumcellae, their place was instantly supplied. The garrisons of Narni, Spoleto, and Perusia were reinforced, and the 7 camps of the besiegers were gradually encompassed with the calamities of a siege. The prayers and pilgrimage of Datius, Bishop of Milan, were not without effect, and he obtained 1,000 Thracians and Isaurians to assist the revolt of Liguria against her Arian tyrant. At the same time, John the Sanguinary, the nephew of Vitalian, was detached with 2,000 chosen horse, first to Alba on the Fucine Lake, and afterwards to the frontiers of Picenum on the Hadriatic Sea. "In the province," said Belisarius, "the Goths have deposited their families and treasures, without a guard or the suspicion of danger. Doubtless they will violate the truce. Let them feel your presence before they hear of your motions. Spare the Italians. Suffer not any fortified places to remain hostile in your rear, and faithfully reserve the spoil for an equal and common partition. It would not be reasonable," he added with a laugh, "that whilst we are toiling to the destruction of the drones, our more fortunate brethren should rival and enjoy the honey." The whole nation of the Ostrogoths had been assembled for the attack, and was almost entirely consumed in the siege of Rome. If any credit be due to an intelligent spectator, 1/3 at least of their enormous host was destroyed in frequent and bloody combats under the walls of the city. The bad fame and pernicious qualities of the summer air might already be imputed to the decay of agriculture and population, and the evils of famine and pestilence were aggravated by their own licentiousness, and the unfriendly disposition of the country. While Vitiges struggled with his fortune, while he hesitated between shame and ruin, his retreat was hastened by domestic alarms. The king of the Goths was informed by trembling messengers that John the Sanguinary spread the devastations of war from the Apennine to the Hadriatic, that the rich spoils and innumerable captives of Picenum were lodged in the fortifications of Rimini, and that this formidable chief had defeated his uncle, insulted his capital,
and seduced by secret correspondence the fidelity of his wife, the imperious daughter of Amalasuntha. Yet before he retired, Vitiges made a last effort either to storm or to surprise the city. A secret passage was discovered in one of the aqueducts. Two citizens of the Vatican were tempted by bribes to intoxicate the guards of the Aurelian Gate. An attack was meditated on the walls beyond the Tiber, in a place which was not fortified with towers, and the barbarians advanced with torches and scaling ladders to the assault of the Pincian Gate. But every attempt was defeated by the intrepid vigilance of Belisarius and his band of veterans, who in the most perilous moments did not regret the absence of their companions. And the Goths, alike destitute of hope and subsistence, clamorously urged their departure before the truce should expire and the Roman cavalry should again be united. 1 year and 9 days after the commencement of the siege, an army so lately strong and triumphant burnt their tents and tumultuously repassed the Milvian Bridge. They repassed not with impunity. Their thronging multitudes, oppressed in a narrow passage, were driven headlong into the Tiber by their own fears and the pursuit of the enemy, and the Roman general, sallying from the Pincian Gate, inflicted a severe and disgraceful wound on their retreat. The slow length of a sickly and desponding host was heavily dragged along the Flaminian Way, from whence the barbarians were sometimes compelled to deviate, lest they should encounter the hostile garrisons that guarded the high road to Rimini and Ravenna. Yet so powerful was this flying army that Vitiges spared 10,000 men for the defense of the cities, which he was most solicitous to preserve, and detached his nephew Urias with an adequate force for the chastisement of rebellious Milan. At the head of his principal army he besieged Rimini, only 33 miles distant from the Gothic capital. A feeble rampart and a shallow ditch were maintained by the skill and valor of John the Sanguinary, who shared the danger and fatigue of the meanest soldier, and emulated on a theatre less illustrious the military virtues of his great commander. The towers and battering engines of the barbarians were rendered useless. Their attacks were repulsed, and the tedious blockade, which reduced the garrison to the last extremity of hunger, afforded time for the union and march of the Roman forces. A fleet, which had surprised Ancona, sailed along the coast of the Hadriatic to the relief of the besieged city. The eunuch Narses landed in Picenum with 2,000 Heruli and 5,000 of the bravest troops of the East. The rock of the Apennine was forced. 10,000 veterans moved round the foot of the mountains under the command of Belisarius himself, and a new army, whose encampment blazed with innumerable lights, appeared to advance along the Flaminian Way. Overwhelmed with astonishment and despair, the Goths abandoned the siege of Rimini, their tents, their standards, and their leaders. And Vitiges, who gave or followed the example of flight, never halted till he found a shelter within the walls and morasses of Ravenna. To these walls and to some fortresses destitute of any mutual support, the Gothic monarchy was now reduced. The provinces of Italy had embraced the party of the emperor, and his army, gradually recruited to the number of 20,000 men, must have achieved an easy and rapid conquest if their invincible powers had not been weakened by the discord of the Roman chiefs. Before the end of the siege, an act of blood, ambiguous and indiscreet, sullied the fair fame of Belisarius. Presidius, a loyal Italian, as he fled from Ravenna to Rome, was rudely stopped by Constantine, the military governor of Spoleto, and despoiled, even in a church, of 2 daggers richly inlaid with gold and precious stones. As soon as the public danger had subsided, Presidius complained of the loss and injury. His complaint was heard, but the order of restitution was disobeyed by the pride and avarice of the offender. Exasperated by the delay, Presidius boldly arrested the general's horse as he passed through the forum,
and with the spirit of a citizen, demanded the common benefit of the Roman laws. The honour of Belisarius was engaged. He summoned a council, claimed the obedience of his subordinate officer, and was provoked by an insolent reply to call hastily for the presence of his guards. Constantine, viewing their entrance as the signal of death, drew his sword and rushed on the general, who nimbly eluded the stroke and was protected by his friends, while the desperate assassin was disarmed, dragged into a neighboring chamber, and executed, or rather murdered by the guards at the arbitrary command of Belisarius. In this hasty act of violence, the guilt of Constantine was no longer remembered. The despair and death of that valiant officer were secretly imputed to the revenge of Antonina, and each of his colleagues, conscious of the same rapine, was apprehensive of the same fate. The fear of a common enemy suspended the effects of their envy and discontent, but in the confidence of approaching victory, they instigated a powerful rival to oppose the conqueror of Rome and Africa. From the domestic service of the palace and the administration of the private revenue, Narses the eunuch was suddenly exalted to the head of an army, and the spirit of a hero who afterwards equaled the merit and glory of Belisarius served only to perplex the operations of the Gothic War. To his prudent counsels, the relief of Rimini was ascribed by the leaders of the discontented faction, who exhorted Narses to assume an independent and separate command. The epistle of Justinian had indeed enjoined his obedience to the general, but the dangerous exception, as far as may be advantageous to the public service, reserved some freedom of judgment to the discreet favorite, who had so lately departed from the sacred and familiar conversation of his sovereign. In the exercise of this doubtful right, the eunuch perpetually dissented from the opinions of Belisarius, and after yielding with reluctance to the siege of Urbino, he deserted his colleague in the night and marched away to the conquest of the Aemilian province. The fierce and formidable bands of the Heruli were attached to the person of Narses. 10,000 Romans and Confederates were persuaded to march under his banners. Every malcontent embraced the fair opportunity of revenging his private or imaginary wrongs, and the remaining troops of Belisarius were divided and dispersed from the garrisons of Sicily to the shores of the Hadriatic. His skill and perseverance overcame every obstacle. Urbino was taken. The sieges of Faesulae, Orvieto, and Uximum were undertaken and vigorously prosecuted, and the eunuch Narses was at length recalled to the domestic cares of the palace. All dissensions were healed, and all opposition was subdued by the temperate authority of the Roman general, to whom his enemies could not refuse their esteem. And Belisarius inculcated the salutary lesson that the forces of the state should compose one body and be animated by one soul. But in the interval of discord, the Goths were permitted to breathe. An important season was lost. Milan was destroyed, and the northern provinces of Italy were afflicted by an inundation of the Franks. When Justinian first meditated the conquest of Italy, he sent ambassadors to the kings of the Franks and adjured them, by the common ties of alliance and religion, to join in the holy enterprise against the Arians. The Goths, as their wants were more urgent, employed a more effectual mode of persuasion, and vainly strove, by the gift of lands and money, to purchase the friendship, or at least the neutrality, of a light and perfidious nation. But the arms of Belisarius and the revolt of the Italians had no sooner shaken the Gothic monarchy than Theodebert of Austrasia, the most powerful and warlike of the Merovingian kings, was persuaded to succor their distress by an indirect and seasonable aid. Without expecting the consent of their sovereign, the 1,000 Burgundians, his recent subjects, descended from the Alps and joined the troops which Vitiges had sent to chastise the revolt of Milan. After an obstinate siege, the capital of Liguria was reduced by famine,
but no capitulation could be obtained, except for the safe retreat of the Roman garrison. Dacius, the Orthodox bishop, who had seduced his countrymen to rebellion and ruin, escaped to the luxury and honours of the Byzantine court. But the clergy, perhaps the Arian clergy, were slaughtered at the foot of their own altars by the defenders of the Catholic faith. 300,000 males were reported to be slain. The female sex and the more precious spoil were resigned to the Burgundians, and the houses, or at least the walls, of Milan were levelled with the ground. The Goths, in their last moments, were revenged by the destruction of a city second only to Rome in size and opulence, in the splendour of its buildings, or the number of its inhabitants. And Belisarius sympathized alone in the fate of his deserted and devoted friends. Encouraged by this successful inroad, Theodebert himself, in the ensuing spring, invaded the plains of Italy with an army of 100,000 barbarians. The king and some chosen followers were mounted on horseback and armed with lances. The infantry, without bows or spears, were satisfied with a shield, a sword, and a double-edged battle-axe, which in their hands became a deadly and unerring weapon. Italy trembled at the march of the Franks, and both the Gothic prince and the Roman general, alike ignorant of their designs, solicited with hope and terror the friendship of these dangerous allies. Till he had secured the passage of the Po on the bridge of Pavia, the grandson of Clovis dissembled his intentions, which he at length declared by assaulting, almost at the same instant, the hostile camps of the Romans and Goths. Instead of uniting their arms, they fled with equal precipitation, and the fertile, though desolate, provinces of Liguria and Aemilia were abandoned to a licentious host of barbarians, whose rage was not mitigated by any thoughts of settlement or conquest. Among the cities which they ruined, Genoa, not yet constructed of marble, is particularly enumerated, and the deaths of thousands, according to the regular practice of war, appear to have excited less horror than some idolatrous sacrifices of women and children, which were performed with impunity in the camp of the most Christian king. If it were not a melancholy truth that the first and most cruel sufferings must be the lot of the innocent and helpless, history might exult in the misery of the conquerors, who in the midst of riches were left destitute of bread or wine, reduced to drink the waters of the Po, and to feed on the flesh of distempered cattle. The dysentery swept away one-third of their army, and the clamours of his subjects, who were impatient to pass the Alps, disposed Theodebert to listen with respect to the mild exhortations of Belisarius. The memory of this inglorious and destructive warfare was perpetuated on the medals of Gaul, and Justinian, without unsheathing his sword, assumed the title of Conqueror of the Franks. The Merovingian prince was offended by the vanity of the emperor. He affected to pity the fallen fortunes of the Goths, and his insidious offer of a federal union was fortified by the promise, or menace, of descending from the Alps at the head of 500,000 men. His plans of conquest were boundless and, perhaps, chimerical. The king of Austrasia threatened to chastise Justinian and to march to the gates of Constantinople. He was overthrown and slain by a wild bull as he hunted in the Belgic or German forests. Part 6. As soon as Belisarius was delivered from his foreign and domestic enemies, he seriously applied his forces to the final reduction of Italy. In the siege of Osimo, the general was nearly transpierced with an arrow, if the mortal stroke had not been intercepted by one of his guards, who lost in that pious office the use of his hand. The Goths of Osimo, 4,000 warriors with those of Faesulae and the Cutian Alps, were among the last to maintain their independence, and their gallant resistance, which almost tired the patience, deserved the esteem of the conqueror.
His prudence refused to subscribe the safe conduct which they asked to join their brethren of Ravenna. But they saved, by an honourable capitulation, one moiety at least of their wealth, with the free alternative of retiring peaceably to their estates, or enlisting to serve the emperor in his Persian wars. The multitudes which yet adhered to the standard of Vitiges far surpassed the number of the Roman troops. But neither prayers, nor defiance, nor the extreme danger of his most faithful subjects could tempt the Gothic king beyond the fortifications of Ravenna. These fortifications were indeed impregnable to the assaults of art or violence, and when Belisarius invested the capital, he was soon convinced that famine only could tame the stubborn spirit of the barbarians. The sea, the land, and the channels of the Po were guarded by the vigilance of the Roman general, and his morality extended the rights of war to the practice of poisoning the waters and secretly firing the granaries of a besieged city. While he pressed the blockade of Ravenna, he was surprised by the arrival of two ambassadors from Constantinople with a treaty of peace, which Justinian had imprudently signed without deigning to consult the author of his victory. By this disgraceful and precarious agreement, Italy and the Gothic treasures were divided, and the provinces beyond the Po were left with the regal title to the successor of Theodoric. The ambassadors were eager to accomplish their salutary commission. The captive Vitiges accepted with transport the unexpected offer of a crown. Honor was less prevalent among the Goths than the want and appetite of food, and the Roman chiefs, who murmured at the continuance of the war, professed implicit submission to the commands of the emperor. If Belisarius had possessed only the courage of a soldier, the laurel would have been snatched from his hand by timid and envious counsels. But in this decisive moment he resolved, with the magnanimity of a statesman, to sustain alone the danger and merit of generous disobedience. Each of his officers gave a written opinion that the siege of Ravenna was impracticable and hopeless. The general then rejected the treaty of partition, and declared his own resolution of leading Vitiges in chains to the feet of Justinian. The Goths retired with doubt and dismay. This peremptory refusal deprived them of the only signature which they could trust, and filled their minds with a just apprehension that a sagacious enemy had discovered the full extent of their deplorable state. They compared the fame and fortune of Belisarius with the weakness of their ill-fated king, and the comparison suggested an extraordinary project to which Vitiges, with apparent resignation, was compelled to acquiesce. Partition would ruin the strength, exile would disgrace the honor of the nation. But they offered their arms, their treasures, and the fortifications of Ravenna if Belisarius would disclaim the authority of a master, accept the choice of the Goths, and assume, as he had deserved, the kingdom of Italy. If the false luster of a diadem could have tempted the loyalty of a faithful subject, his prudence must have foreseen the inconstancy of the barbarians, and his rational ambition would prefer the safe and honorable station of a Roman general. Even the patience and seeming satisfaction with which he entertained a proposal of treason might be susceptible of a malignant interpretation. But the lieutenant of Justinian was conscious of his own rectitude. He entered into a dark and crooked path, as it might lead to the voluntary submission of the Goths, and his dexterous policy persuaded them that he was disposed to comply with their wishes without engaging an oath or a promise for the performance of a treaty which he secretly abhorred. The day of the surrender of Ravenna was stipulated by the Gothic ambassadors. A fleet, laden with provisions, sailed as a welcome guest into the deepest recess of the harbor. The gates were opened to the fancied king of Italy, and Belisarius, without meeting an enemy, triumphantly marched through the streets of an impregnable city. The Romans were astonished by their success. The multitudes of tall and robust barbarians were confounded by the image of their own patience, and the masculine females, spitting in the faces of their sons and husbands, most bitterly reproached them for betraying their dominion and freedom to these pygmies of the south, contemptible in their numbers, diminutive in their stature. Before the Goths could recover from the first surprise and claim the accomplishment of their doubtful hopes, the victor established his power in Ravenna, beyond the danger of repentance and revolt. Vitiges, who perhaps had attempted to escape, was honorably guarded in his palace. The flower of the Gothic youth was selected for the service of the emperor. The remainder of the people was dismissed to their peaceful habitations in the southern provinces, and a colony of Italians was invited to replenish the depopulated city. The submission of the capital was imitated in the towns and villages of Italy, which had not been subdued or even visited by the Romans, and the independent Goths who remained in arms at Pavia and Verona were ambitious only to become the subjects of Belisarius. But his inflexible loyalty rejected, except as the substitute of Justinian, their oaths of allegiance, and he was not offended by the reproach of their deputies that he rather chose to be a slave than a king. After the second victory of Belisarius, envy again whispered. Justinian listened, and the hero was recalled. The remnant of the Gothic war was no longer worthy of his presence. A gracious sovereign was impatient to reward his services and to consult his wisdom, and he alone was capable of defending the East against the innumerable armies of Persia. Belisarius understood the suspicion, accepted the excuse, embarked at Ravenna his spoils and trophies, and proved by his ready obedience that such an abrupt removal from the government of Italy was not less unjust than it might have been indiscreet. The emperor received with honorable courtesy both Vitiges and his more noble consort, and as the king of the Goths conformed to the Athanasian faith, he obtained, with a rich inheritance of land in Asia, the rank of senator and patrician. Every spectator admired, without peril, the strength and stature of the young barbarians. They adored the majesty of the throne, and promised to shed their blood in the service of their benefactor. Justinian deposited in the Byzantine palace the treasures of the Gothic monarchy. A flattering senate was sometimes admitted to gaze on the magnificent spectacle, but it was enviously secluded from the public view, and the conqueror of Italy renounced, without a murmur, perhaps without a sigh, the well-earned honors of a second triumph. His glory was indeed exalted above all external pomp, and the faint and hollow praises of the court were supplied, even in a servile age, by the respect and admiration of his country. Whenever he appeared in the streets and public places of Constantinople, Belisarius attracted and satisfied the eyes of the people. His lofty stature and majestic countenance fulfilled their expectations of a hero. The meanest of his fellow citizens were emboldened by his gentle and gracious demeanor, and the martial train which attended his footsteps left his person more accessible than in a day of battle. 7,000 horsemen, matchless for beauty and valor, were maintained in the service and at the private expense of the general. Their prowess was always conspicuous in single combats or in the foremost ranks, and both parties confessed that in the siege of Rome the guards of Belisarius had alone vanquished the barbarian host. Their numbers were continually augmented by the bravest and most faithful of the enemy, and his fortunate captives, the Vandals, the Moors, and the Goths, emulated the attachment of his domestic followers. By the union of liberality and justice, he acquired the love of the soldiers, without alienating the affections of the people. The sick and wounded were relieved with medicines and money, and still more efficaciously by the healing visits and smiles of their commander. The loss of a weapon or a horse was instantly repaired, and each deed of valor was rewarded by the rich and honorable gifts of a bracelet or a collar, which were rendered more precious by the judgment of Belisarius. He was endeared to the husbandman by the peace and plenty which they enjoyed under the shadow of his standard. Instead of being injured, the country was enriched by the march of the Roman armies, and such was the rigid